Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Duane Lucas. Lucas is an assistant professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. His areas of expertise and interest include the growing partisan divide in the House of Representatives, political parties, minority group politics, elections, and voting. Welcome to the show, Duane.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, I want to ask you this. Cynicism about politics and our political systems has been rising since Watergate, Vietnam. So what inspired you to go into this field?
I've always been amazed by what's drawn the parties apart. Because I remember a time, or rather, I remember my parents talking about a time where you still saw cynicism, but you also saw partisan operations across parties, Democrats working with Republicans, Republicans working with Democrats. And I found that very interesting that as I was going to college and starting to see the evidence of the parties going in separate ways, of Democrats not talking so much to Republicans, Republicans not talking to Democrats. And I got sort of caught up in, what was this pull? Why are we moving further and further apart? I sort of remember my grandfather sort of telling me about, he remembers times when the Democrats and Republicans would talk readily, and it meant nothing to say that I was a Democrat or a Republican. You didn't really know anything about a person's political beliefs, their ideology, their thoughts on any issue just by knowing their partisanship. You had to go deeper. And today you see this stark divide between Democrats who are pro-abortion, pro-gay rights, pro-immigrant rights, pro-environment, where you see Republicans being more conservative, more supportive of big business, more supportive of corporate interests. So that movement to me has always been interesting, but that movement more particular, or more specifically in terms of Congress itself, has to me just been amazing.
You almost need to be a psychologist to figure out what's going on with these guys.
Sometimes I think I am. And I'll tell you, I pull a lot of my research from psychology and sociology to sort of understand what's going on.
Oh, I'll bet you do. Yeah. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, you're interested in many areas and issues. But I want to start with this. I wanted to ask a political scientist this. The disputed 2000 election. Do you think that the Supreme Court's decision has changed our political landscape irreversibly?
Well, I'm not sure irreversibly. I think what the court faced was really a question about state rights versus federal rights, but versus these national goals and who can instruct state elections on how to behave. And so their real goal was basically just setting out that landscape or solving that question. The court likes to pride itself on not addressing what they call political questions, things that the that representatives, government should decide. And they want to just solve the basic questions, the constitutional questions. And so what the court did in 2000 was sort of read this electoral scenario. Here you have the state, the Secretary of State, the state election board saying, hey, we're done with the vote counts. And you have a candidate saying, no, you're not. There's these other votes that need to be counted. In the courts saying, hey, in this case, we have to side with the courts, or we have to side with the states. And for a lot of people, that came out to look as if the court, and yes, given the court's bent, the conservative bent of the court, it's understandable that it looked as if the court was deciding that, hey, this was the court stepping in, giving Bush the election, taken away from Gore. But there was also this other element of the 2000 election.
So much of the population doesn't understand that.
So, yeah.
So regardless of whether, you know, technically you're right that it was about a state's rights issue, it does look like the court decided that election because, in fact, there were votes that hadn't been counted.
Right.
All that goes back to racism and, you know,
and class and
disenfranchised voters all over Florida and so on. So do you think because the public perceives this not as a state issue, but as an intrusion, that it will change our electoral politics for many years to come?
I think it will. I think what's going to happen election-wise, and we saw this in 2004, is that both parties, both camps, are going to really be ready to fight the legal battle just as much as they fight the electoral battle. And you saw Kerry, for instance, in 2004 being pressured, or I shouldn't say pressured, but leaning towards bringing in his lawyers, or having before the election, there was talk about how both parties, Bush and Kerry, had planes of lawyers ready to go to wherever there's going to be a trouble spot.
Yeah, and then people tried to say that Ohio was a trouble spot.
Becomes this big example, and people are saying Kerry should send lawyers in and we should challenge the case. And so I think what we're going to see for elections in the future is not so elections aren't going to be decided on that Tuesday anymore, that first Tuesday. Elections, we may have to start thinking about them being decided a month later, which I don't know if that's going to be a great thing for anybody, except for us political junkies. But,
I want to bring up the fact that you've also argued in a paper that you wrote that so many representatives in Congress have become more responsive to party partisanship than to their constituency. Now, has that always been the case, or have things really gotten worse?
I really think things have gotten worse, in that I'm not sure in my research yet if it's a case of the representatives are just following the party or the parties just controlling the representatives better. Because the parties have increasing resources at their disposal, from fundraising to committee assignments, to
lobbyists,
to and so the parties have become much, much stronger these days. One of the things I did a class on political parties last semester, just finished it up. One of the things I started out with this class was think about what happened in the 2006 election. First thing that came out was Nancy Pelosi stepping forward and saying, here's the Democratic agenda. Here's what we are going to do as the Democratic Party and the majority party. You didn't see that 40 years ago. It was parties had to work to get their members to agree on one position, one issue, and oftentimes they failed. One of the ways political scientists liked in the past to study parties was we used to look at this group, what we called the conservative coalition in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And it was made up of, and we said, conservative coalition formed anytime a majority of Republicans and conservative Democrats joined together against a majority of Northern Democrats. Mm. And we used that as a measure both of bipartisan cooperation, Democrats and Republicans uniting, but also as a sign of the failure, inability of the Democratic Party to hold on to a majority vote in the House. The Congressional Quarterly used to keep this number. They stopped keeping this number about 10 years ago, because in 97, the percentage of votes was something like 5%. Compared to the 1960s, 1970s, when the numbers were as high as 25-30% of the vote.
Are you talking about partisanship or
In terms of how often members were crossing party lines.
Oh, I see.
In the 60s, 70s, we saw members crossing party lines about a quarter of a time to a third of a time. Now we're seeing them rarely cross party lines.
Yeah, I have noticed that too. Now, you also wrote an article, and I think this is really interesting. And your idea was, because of the enormous increase in population in the last 100 years, that we should really seriously consider increasing the size of the House of Representatives. Talk to me about that.
Yeah.
I mean, we already have so much partisanship. Would anything get done?
I'm one of the few optimists that thinks something will be done. And I based that study on a number of things. One of the big things is sort of our history. And our history with the House of Representatives in the U.S. is that even back in the 1800s, late 1700s, when we were apportioning seats, Congress would take up apportionment every 10 years right after the census, and they'll sort of say, we're getting bigger, so let's get the House of Representatives bigger. And the reason was because we wanted the House of Representatives to be the people's branch, and the ability of the people to control their representatives is better if there's more representatives to control than whether there's a few to control. Mm-hmm. And so from the late 1700s up until about 1920, we would reapportion the size of the House and make it bigger and bigger up until it reached 435. Then in 1920s, we just stopped.
Really? Really? Mm-hmm. Even though the population has moved from like 100 million to 300 million?
Exactly.
Has it been brought up by anybody?
It's been brought up. A few political scientists bring up the question of we should make the House larger in order for it to be more representative. We do this historical aspect for the U.S., but we also do this comparison of houses, houses of representatives in other countries. Mm. And we find that basically, and I hope this doesn't become too statistical for anyone, but basically what happens is that the effective size of a House of Representatives, a people's chamber, is about the cube root of the population. Okay. That's the way other countries have done it. We've done
it. And explain what that means, though.
That means if you took the population of the United States and took the cube root of that, that's about the average number of representatives that nation would have. The cube root would be if you have to think of this in reverse, but the cube would be a number times itself times itself.
Mm-hmm. And so where are we now with having 435 in regard to the population?
Our current population, if we use the cube root, we should have about 600 members of Congress.
Really? More people to rip off and take money from the corporations, as the cynical people in our country would say, right?
Right. That's one way to look at it, but the optimist says 600 more people for the people to control. Mm. Instead of trying to represent, for instance, hope I get his district right, Ithaca to Geneva, having one representative representing the entire area and more, we could have two or three representatives picking up on these local issues. And the idea, the ones that the founders started off with, was that by having these local representatives, the people can have greater influence, greater control over their members. Now, does the cube root law says we should be closer to 600. Doesn't say we have to be at 600, mm-hmm. but I actually think if we got a few more, if we got 500, we'll have greater ability for the people to influence their members and greater ability for that influence to counter the lobbyists, to counter mm-hmm. the parties.
And it might make people feel like they're back in control of their government, which
control.
It's just run rampant how people don't think they're controlling their government at all, that the government's controlling them and the corporations are controlling the government, you know.
Right. Because it's easier for the corporations to control a small group of representatives than it would be to control a larger
group.
That's
an interesting take on that, huh? Well, I hope you'll start pushing for this, Dwayne. I want to talk about the fact that in 2004 you were named a Congressional Fellow by the American Political Science Association. And I understand that you had an opportunity to work in Congressman Rangel's office.
I did.
Tell me what that was like.
It was a very interesting time. Because Rangel, the Democrats were still in the minority, but he was still an influential member because he was one of the few that tried to reach out to Republicans and tried to work across the aisles for his big issues. And so I worked for his personal office, not his Ways and Means. He has two staffs. He has his personal staff for his district and then a Ways and Means staff for work on Ways and Means. I worked in his personal office and helped out on issues related to the district. And so he has a small staff there. There are, if I recall correctly, there's like six permanent staffers, and then they hire interns and fellows to assist.
That's interesting. So you actually got to directly talk to of the people he represents, right?
I answer the phones. Rangel's protocols is everyone answers the phones. If it rings, you pick it up.
That's great.
And so I got to talk to people back home in the district. I got to talk to people who were calling because of something he was working on. I got to talk to people who were interested in some legislation he was working with that wanted input into it. Also got to work on legislation. So I was in charge of environmental issues. I helped him with his draft bill. I helped him with other related issues.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dwayne Lucas. He's an assistant professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. We're talking about the fact that he had an opportunity to work in Congressman Charles Rangel's office a couple of years ago. I wanted to ask you, were you surprised by anything in that office? Were you surprised by how many people were really involved in what their congressperson's doing?
I was surprised by how many people called and wanted an input. And when they called, it wasn't so much that maybe 1 out of 100 calls were someone who actually wanted to speak to Mr. Rangel. Mm. But most of the calls were someone saying, I'm in his district. I want him to know he's doing a good job. Or I wanted him to know I saw him on MSNBC talking about the war, and uh-huh. I think he's right on ball. Or someone calling to say, I heard he's proposing this piece of legislation. I don't want him to do it, or I do want to do it. And so in part of my responsibilities, as well as the rest of the staff, was that we sort of had to respond to them. We had to sort of say, well, thank you, either thank you for your support, or yeah, he did this, but this is why he did it. This is why he thinks this is important. And yes, your concern is important to him too, but for the entire district, for the country, whatever the reference was, this is why he's taking this position.
Wow.
And so we had, I won't say I saw Congressman Rangel every day, but when he's in office, he always comes by and says hi, or he will have a conversation. If it's a big piece of legislation that he's doing or something big he's doing, he'll sort of brief the staff about why he's doing it, what he thinks. He'll ask for our input. And it was a great opportunity. One of the other things that did surprise me was that how often the staffs, Republican and Democratic staffs, actually work together. That one of the stories Mr. Rangel or Congressman Rangel used to tell was that he remembers when he first started that he would be on the floor of the House and he'll be arguing vehemently with the Republican side, and after they finish arguing, the two would say, hey, let's go out for dinner, finish this conversation, or let's just go out and dinner, talk about the kids or something like that. And he said that since the 90s, he's barely seen other Republicans in these social scenarios.
It's just like entirely different worlds that they've created.
It's totally different worlds, but at the same time, it was still not uncommon for a Democratic staff and the Republican staffers to be walking in the same direction, to be talking about common issues, not necessarily putting their two members together, but still talking about, hey, I'm working on this bill, I'm having a hard time finding so-and-so, do you know how to get in touch with them, those kind of things.
Well,
those kind of conversations
that gives
are still,
you hope. That gives you hope.
That does give
you
hope.
You know, which does bring me to my next question to you. Do you believe that in order for our democracy to remain vibrant and to survive, do we really need to start looking beyond the two-party system at this point?
I'm not sure. I'm actually an advocate for strong parties. But I want to say the current party system is by no way anything I would advocate for.
So you believe in the two-party system, but you want drastic change?
I would love to see drastic change. I'm in political science, I'm what people call a responsible party person. I believe that what should be going on is that we can run two parties, but they need to be clear about what they're going to stand for. They need to say, hey, we're going to be the party that's going to get us out of Iraq, and we're going to be the party that's going to keep us in Iraq. Let voters choose between those two distinct policies. Then when they're elected to office, they say the party that wins does what it says it's going to do. And that system, the two-party approach helps it better because you're giving people the choices and they can say, okay, if we get a Democratic Congress, we're going to get X, Y, and Z.
But see, that happened in the last election. We got a Democratic Congress, and they have been absolutely stifled in regard to what they've promised to do in regard to Iraq.
Right. But I think their reason for being stifled is because they're not clear on what they're not responsible. They're not clear.
They're not speaking
on what,
with one voice. Huh?
Right.
Yeah.
They're not clear. If you take, for instance, the recent Iraq, the funding bill, they're not clear as a party that their reason for winning the election was to get troops out of Iraq. Because at least in my mind, if they were clear about that, they would still be sending Bush that same appropriations bill with timetable saying we're going to get out of Iraq. Over and over again.
Yeah.
So Pelosi has this challenge of pulling together Democrats that want us out of Iraq today and those that want us out of Iraq in 10 years. And she has to find some common ground to keep all of those Democrats together.
Yeah.
That I think is part of our current problem with our party system.
Now, one of your interests is also what you refer to as minority group politics. Tell me what that means. Is there really a defined minority group politics?
There's not one minority group. I look at minority group politics, I look at it through two particular groups, African Americans and gays and lesbians. But I define minority group politics generally as groups that aren't in the majority, groups that don't have the electoral or political power or resources to affect policy, and looking at how they try to influence the political system as a minority group as opposed to being in the majority, being in control.
Mm-hmm. And so how are those two groups, African Americans and gay and lesbian people, doing?
Both of them, and I think my predominant study of them as factors within the Democratic Party, is that they're both struggling to be effective in that leadership. African Americans are probably more effective, but that's because they're more organized. They have the Congressional Black Caucus is currently at 44 members, and they've been there since the 1960s, and they have senior members like Congressman Rangel, as well as junior members like Congressman Moore from Wisconsin, who come in with this uniting agenda, and they don't see their issues as particular to their districts. They see their issues as national issues, and so they face this challenge of articulating that interest to the party as a whole. And so they're trying to find ways of being both Democrats and being African-American Democrats, mm-hmm. and looking at this is what we think African-Americans want for this country. This is what's best for their interests. And then not only formulating that position amongst themselves, they also have to try to formulate it within the Democratic Party as a whole, or at times reaching out to Republicans and doing that. For gays and lesbians, their challenge, they have a different set of challenges, because not because they're new, but because as a political force, they're new.
Exactly, yeah.
They don't have the organizational structure that the Congressional Black Caucus has. I haven't looked at these numbers lately, but I think there's two openly gay members of Congress who are influential members of Congress, but they don't have a catalyst for developing one single agenda.
Yeah, well, there isn't one single agenda,
right,
in the gay and lesbian community.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk to you also about how has the Internet changed political discourse in this country? Is it good or bad? And, you know, has the chatter reached levels where people are tuning it out? Or is democracy expanding because of it?
I think it's expanding. And I'll try to put some context in it. I would say 3-4 years ago, I would rarely look for anything on the Internet news related. I now have a list of about 10 websites from both a liberal and a conservative perspective that are just blogs about people talking about their take on different issues. And I sort of like going through and just reading what their issues are and how they respond to the same event, but differently. And they see things through not only ideological lenses, but through partisan lenses. And so I think the Internet's sort of been this mobilizing force that has sort of united people around various issues, and so people can be self-selective in terms of their information. So they find this one blogger who has a similar ideology, similar thoughts on governments or on the parties, on the issues, and they sort of, I read their comments, and you can see all these different people weighing in and feeling as if they're participating in that process. And I think we saw in 2004 sort of a big movement of those Internet users, Internet users as well as bloggers, in sort of the rise of Howard Dean as
a
candidate.
You saw
a lot of it in 2006 with people starting to mobilize and planning and strategize. Here's a candidate.
MoveOn.org was one organization that was incredibly effective.
Very effective.
They didn't win everything, but they certainly got out there.
They got their issues out. They got people mobilized. They had house parties in local communities. And so I think the Internet has been this effective voice for, ideally, I like to see the Internet as this effective voice for bringing people into the political system, and that people can get a greater sense of what the issues are, what they need to do, how to do that, and they're not feeling so isolated, separated from a bigger agenda.
So as a political science teacher, obviously you teach and young people come into your classroom. How do you inspire some of these cynical, perhaps young people to want to get involved in the system and involved in their democracy and so on?
I would say it's getting easier to inspire them. And what I'm finding, or what we find at Hobart and William Smith College, is that a lot of our students come in not necessarily with a goal of political engagement, but a goal of community social engagement. And so they come to the campus, and we take them out and they do community service. And we find that they're already doing community service on their own. And is they're getting to, by the time they get to my classes, they're now thinking of how do I translate my community service into the bigger community? How do I translate my word, what I've seen in working in soup kitchens or working in shelters, working with the homeless, how do I translate that into policy changes at the national, or not even the national level, but at the local level? And so I've been finding that for college students at least, that community engagement has become this mechanism for political action, or at least this interest in political action.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
And even to the point where I have had a senior last semester, she's now graduated, who majored in political science and who was a champion of community activity, but she still come to the realization that politics isn't the best way to achieve her goals. She thinks she sees the best way to change the U.S., to change her community, is to work more at the community level, at the local level, and then think about bridging gaps at the political level. And she sees it more, if you're not active at the political level, be active at the community level, and then you'll see political activity.
We only have about a minute left. I just want to ask you one final question.
Okay.
Since you've been delving into the political process, has the knowledge and so on that you've gained made you more cynical or more hopeful about our democracy and the future?
This week I'll say more cynical. there are moments. There are times when you look, when I look at the big picture, I really, at times now, I think there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of promise. We have young voters that are coming in. We have people who are becoming more entrenched. We're making movements towards greater democracy, at least at the local level, if not in government. But at the same time, I see these episodes where you expect the party, the system, to respond differently than it did. And it's about trying to find a way to keep the local activism connected with the national, the internal activism.
Dwayne, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been
for
a pleasure.
Having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.